This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A puppy has lost his bones, and the search is on to find those lost treats. That's an extremely brief summary of the new book by Amy Jussel called The Secret of the Vanishing Bones, Tracking the Data Trail. The book is aimed at students in grades K through 5, and it uses the story to teach young people about keeping their data private and gives them a first look at media literacy in the digital age. Amy Jussel is the founder of Shaping Youth, a group that uses media literacy, film, policy advocacy, and social media campaigns to counter the influence of media marketing and data mining on young people. I asked why she wanted to tell this story to this audience.
Well, I chose the framing of digital dogs because I thought that would be a safe, easy place to be able to springboard off of these conversations, even though dogs don't talk, etc. I felt that more and more media literacy needs to be front and center from kindergarten to grade 5 and even preschool. There are so many things you can do to embed media literacy early on. I don't think we can wait until middle school and high school anymore. I think with all the disinformation and misinformation online and the data privacy issues and the online breaches and leaks and other things, kids need to understand what is and isn't personal data and, you know, how, when they click and swipe, where that lands.
And this, of course, is not a topic that existed when you or I were in middle school.
That is correct. However, media literacy has existed for ages, and our National Association of Media Literacy Educators has been around since 1997. If nothing else, this has put it in the forefront of the need to knows. And, you know, we've gotten a big boost because there's so much misinformation and it's taken off in such a big way. We need to be able to instill this. I would still say the UK does a much better job in terms of framing media literacy and looking at the online environment. But I think the US really needs to bring it front and center. Right now, it's just a Wild West frontier. Tech has gotten way ahead of us. So.
Well, let's back up a bit and get basic. How would you define media literacy?
Well, I think the National Association would define it, the academics define it as the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act using all forms of communication. I would take it a step further in terms of the critical thinking and the ability to encode and decode using media in all its forms to synthesize and analyze and produce all these mediated messages. I think that t-shirts are media. I think that stop signs are media. I think kids need to understand that everything is a construct.
And how do you start to tell that story to a kindergartner, to fifth grader in book form?
You can start in activities. I actually come from a branding and marketing background. And I think that a lot of these are springboards where you can do little things like taking them on a grocery store hunt, you know, with your mom and dad, you know, when you're shopping, you know, look at the receipts, understand when you buy something, notice how those receipts might translate the next time you shop. Do those receipts follow you to the next time you're shopping somewhere else? Do you get coupons for that? You know, how much of that data is being saved and profiled on who you are and what you buy and what you do? Those are little tiny scavenger hunts, I guess you would call them, for media literacy. And I have used that a lot of times with label literacy, like junk food and things like that, you know, the new and improved. When you start hitting kids with the toys and the foods and really simple things that are in their world all the time, they start to understand the inquiry. And I my whole objective is just to instill inquiry early, often, make it a habit.
And how do you do that with a puppy looking for his bones?
Well, the puppy looking for its bones is all about tracking data and how much gets leaked out. And this puppy tracking its bones, it ironically, I don't want to give up the ending, but it takes you on all kinds of red herrings and makes you think that it's all about the technology. And it turns out to not even be a technology issue. But along the way, the kids are learning. Each of the books has three learning takeaways. The interesting thing for me when I created it was realizing that different kids take different things out of this. And For me, I think that a lot is socioeconomic, a lot is where they live, where they come from, what their environment is. And I think that some of the kids take an anti-bullying message. Some of the kids take the puppy was a stray message. You know, I mean, there are a lot of different framing aspects to it. But the puppy and the bones, the tracking the data trail is really trying to take a neutral stance on data. And I'm trying to explain that data can be used for good. It can be used for not so good. You just need to be aware of what's leaking out. And particularly in this era of data breaches and everything else, it's really important. So I created a whole 20-page adjunct piece that goes into activities that teachers can use and AI and, you know, the cost of free. Is that app really free? Is that game really free? Did you have to, you know, jump on deck and fill out a bunch of forms to say who you are in order to access it? Those kinds of early inquiry questions, the kids start to get inoculated with not just the media misinformation, but exploitation. They start to see that they are part of the product.
If you were to try to teach this lesson to older students, would you take this same approach or would you be a little more direct?
Well, certainly more direct. The book itself, I break into two parts. On the activity guide, I have a K-2, even have coloring pages, actually. It basically gets kids to understand, you know, who's asking for it? Why is my contact data needed? How will it be used? Do I have any controls? And just even coloring pages for the kindergartners to find as many media messages as you can, just looking around the classroom. And I think those kind of things, when you take it down to a coloring level, a base level, you're starting to instill that inquiry and the practice of critical thinking habits early on. When you get to the third to fifth grade level, one of the things I was noticing with Reading Buddies is these kids love to teach the kindergartners. So if you have the third to fifth graders sort of helping teach the kindergarten and first graders, they learn a lot. They can talk about the way that they use media and how they make sure that the algorithms, for instance, a kindergarten may not know what an algorithm is, but they certainly understand why recommendations are coming to them and they continue to come to them. And an older kid can certainly get in there and talk about all the what ifs there. That's one of my biggest concerns right now with the algorithms is not just the bias, but the filter bubbles, because kids, the data mining is starting to get very pronounced where, say you like horses, for instance, you know, you're suddenly served a ton of horses. Well, horses might be a fleeting fancy. You may not want to be into horses all your life, but next thing you know, Amazon, everybody else is serving you horses for life. So those kind of things, they need to understand that construct early and often.
How has the pandemic changed how young children consume media?
Well, obviously the forcing of the schools online started all kinds of jumping in with both feet. I think the biggest thing with my concern with that is not just the always on, but the fact that the parents were also under the gun and not understanding the controls, the safety messages, all those good things. When we find out, for instance, that 60% of the apps are sharing the kids' data with third parties, you know, you always think that schools and parents and all that know their stuff. And when you start to see the way that this levels out, it's a bit disconcerting, particularly with educational apps, things like when you're looking up the school's schedule or calendars or whatever, you just don't think about that. The pandemic, the children's engagement with the digital devices and screen time has been more than doubled. I mean, I know Pew Research gets into this where they talk about kids that are frankly really young, that one in five kids under 11 even have their own smartphones. And that was sort of my impetus to tackle this early on. I was working in a bunch of schools doing volunteer work for AmeriCorps in a Reading Partners program. And these kids that were very young, K-2, could swipe and pinch and spread information, but they had no idea where it was landing or what it was doing. And so they're being given the phones, but they aren't given the skills, not just in digital literacy, but in media literacy.
And I imagine since that screen is now school, well, then that screen has been, you know, all good information comes out of that screen. And you really have to say, okay, school is over. Now you're back to being sold stuff.
Right. And the thing is, I think what teachers and educators also need to remember is, you know, COVID and ed tech, you know, Google Classroom, for instance, which a lot of the schools are using, you know, also has third-party app trackers on it. And the breaches and the information that can be gleaned. For some reason, schools are a big target right now, as are institutions like hospitals. So when you look at exploitation of data and information, a lot of these schools are just too big. They don't have it in lockdown. They haven't figured out how to control this data and this information. There are all kinds of new things, biometrics, there are voice prints, there's facial recognition, there's all these different surveillance technologies that are taking place. And parents and educators just can't keep up. It's very overwhelming. So I think that the whole series, I just decided I'm going to start tackling this, whether it's the first one is all about data tracking, but I'm going to be looking at Internet of Things, some of the toys that engage with you. I'm going to be looking at misinformation. I'm going to be looking at AI and the bias, you know, having to do with ethics. I like the whole notion of trying to tell kids to be aware, not to beware, but to be aware. And I think these are all things that we should have been doing for the last 20 years. And we haven't, and we're behind. I think the data tracking and the data privacy, the reason I focused on that first is that I didn't know even, and I'm in media literacy, I didn't realize that you could put in a site, for instance, one of the coloring pages I have basically has it where you can use the QR code and put in any site. I put in your site, for example, just to see what the trackers were.
Uh-oh.
You guys did pretty well, actually, but NPR, you know, they will tell you under, it's a website privacy inspector, you know, ad trackers are found on the site, you know, here's third-party cookies were found. The website loads trackers on the computer. When you visit the site, it tells Facebook. The site allows Google Analytics to follow you across the internet. You know, here are some of the ad tech companies this website interacts with. I found it to be very interesting to see that even things like NPR, you would think, well, that's, again, safe. You think of schools and parents and public radio as all being, oh, well, that's not monetized. That's not coinage and consumption. And I think that's where
Surprise. We
really need to start paying attention. Yes, because they embed them, you know, the ad trackers, they are embedded on your site until you are aware of it and can start taking steps to remove all that.
Again, the name of Amy Jussel's new children's book is The Secret of the Vanishing Bones, Tracking the Data Trail. You can learn more at shapingyouth.org. Still to come, we'll look at another series of children's books. This time, it's all about bugs. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Bugs are everywhere, And most kids love discovering a new creepy crawly now and then. Now a pair of children's books are making it easier for young students to become budding entomologists. The books are called Insects and Bugs for Kids and Insects and Bugs Backyard Workbook, and they're written by Dr. Jarrett Daniels, a curator at the Florida Museum of Natural History and an associate professor at the University of Florida at Gainesville. I asked why he wanted to teach young students about bugs.
I think it's a natural, and the fact that I do work at a museum which has a public-facing mission, I think it's really important that we try to connect people with the natural world. And my lab particularly works on insect conservation. So in order to have effective conservation, you need to get people interested and involved. And, you know, kids are a natural. They're outside. They want to rummage through leaf litter, turn over logs, look for creepy crawlies. And so it's really important, I think, to get kids using their science inquiry skills, getting them outside, seeing what really cool things are, you know, right outside their door. You don't have to travel to Yellowstone to find some really cool insects.
Kids get to balance the coolness and the ick factor all in one.
They do, yeah. And they bring the parents along, which is great because, you know, as kids go, parents often go. And so it's really an activity for the whole family to participate in. And I think insects are that natural initial kind of interest. And then as kids start seeing more and more, they get interested in plants and birds and really anything, you know, natural. And so I think that's it's a great connector to bust away from looking at screens to understand there's some really amazing critters out there to enjoy.
As you were putting this together and gathering your information and how to present it, what age group were you aiming for?
Really, the information is basic enough and interesting enough that it can run the gamut from younger kids to older kids. It's really kind of introducing the biology of insects, you know, the different groups of insects. And then maybe more importantly is sort of how do I go about looking for insects out my back door and where to find them and what to look for? What are signs of, or evidence that they're there? And then how do I identify what I see? And so those are kind of the process steps, if you will.
You do, however, do get kind of technical in there, giving some of the, you know, the technical names of the different insects and the different species.
Oh, yeah. And I don't think we should talk down to children or to families. I mean, you know, the terminology that, you know, we use as professionals, it's understandable. And one thing I've learned in my time at the Florida Museum is kids, they soak up the information and they're the ones that are telling their parents about what they're seeing at the museum. So they know the terminology and it just seems appropriate to not insult their intelligence. They can learn the words, they can learn the terminology, and it just gets them further down the road.
As you interact with young students at the museum, what do they seem interested in when you talk insects?
Well, I think, you know, like adults, they're interested in what is that? What does it do? Where does it live? You know, kind of all the basic things. And then, of course, anything that looks, you know, ferocious or scary or icky or whatever, they gravitate towards those kind of things, like large caterpillars that have horns on them. That's really cool and exciting. And many of them have never seen that before out in the wild. So it's those kind of, you know, miniature little monsters, if you will, in that kind of context. It's really interesting. Or you tell them an interesting fact about an insect and get their attention that way, you know, that this honeybee does X, Y, or Z, and they've never heard of that before. And so it's, you know, insects are great because you can teach anything from language to mathematics to, you know, science through that world, through that lens. And so it's just catching their attention in one way, shape, or form.
I do see in the book that when you're talking about the common fly, you defend the fly's looks. That was a bold move.
Yeah, no, I mean, insects, you know, they get a bad rap, arguably. I mean, most of what we see in the media, online, you know, is painting insects in a bad light as something to be feared, something to be exterminated. And the real truth is that we would be in a real challenging environment if we didn't have insects around and all the services they provide, from pollination to nutrient recycling, decomposition. So it's really important what they all do, and they're working for us free of charge.
And you see it important to teach the kids of their importance, don't you?
Definitely, because I think it's too easy to trivialize, you know, smaller creatures. And I think once they start understanding what they do and their biology, it's a whole new world that opens up. And it's appreciation that, you know, it's, you know, all this biodiversity, if you will, is all connected. The insects that are pollinating blueberry fields, they put crops and food on my table. You know, the insects that are working to feed within logs that have fallen in the forest, they're decomposing those logs and returning nutrients back to the soil. And many of these are just really fascinating also to watch and enjoy. So, you know, it's really important to talk about why they are important, what is their value, because that's the only way we're going to develop that ethic to conserve them.
What are some ways that students and their parents can get started studying the insects right in their backyard?
Well, I think it's just going out and spending time outside and watching and looking closely. And I think most people will be amazed at what organisms actually occur, you know, just in their own yard, let alone walking down to a neighboring park or, you know, a vacant lot. We have an existing living butterfly conservatory at the Florida Museum, and we get people that come through all the time, and they're amazed that, you know, these hundreds of free-flying butterflies from all around the world. And I often get emails, you know, after their visit saying, I went home and now I have all these butterflies in my backyard. Where did they come from? Well, of course, they've been there all the time. You just now are paying attention to them because of that experience that you had at the Florida Museum. So it's the same premise, getting outside looking, and you'll be amazed at what is visiting the flowers in your yard, what is munching on the leaves, what, you know, is in a neighboring pond in your neighborhood. And so it's just looking closely and finding out what's there. And then once you can put a name to it, it's a pretty amazing world. It's like a miniature safari.
And do you get into some of the different regions where you'll find different insects more often?
These books are meant for Southern Canada and the U.S. So many of the species that I cover are ones that are wide ranging. So if you live in New York or you live in Florida or California, it's meant to include as many of the more commonly encountered wide ranging species that kids and families are going to encounter. And in many cases, there are also groups of insects like, say, fireflies. And there are many, many species of fireflies, but it's just introducing that organism group to the audience and starting to look, you know, as the sun sets, what do you see in your backyard or a neighboring park, and getting them interested that way.
I don't know. I got relatives in New York. I don't know how they would react to a palmetto bug in their kitchen.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, some of the, you know, many of the insects and other insect relatives, you know, they can be kind of scary. But once you actually understand them, I think, you know, more people will be interested in them and gravitate towards them than running the opposite direction. There are very few that are going to be really harmful. And most of them, if you know, you know, how to deal with them and you use caution, they're perfectly safe.
And are you hoping maybe some teachers might pick up one of these books or both of these books and use them in class?
Definitely. I think, you know, they are geared for, you know, homeschoolers or, you know, use in the formal classroom and, you know, any outreach and educational opportunities too, you know, summer camps, any of those types of opportunities. And again, they're basic enough and they're, you can kind of go through them a little at a time. So it's manageable, and they can also be really good field companions. You can take them out as you go explore a natural area near your school or the schoolyard if it has a pollinator garden or, you know, a neighboring area on a field trip. So they're meant to be carry along books.
Again, the name of Jarrett Daniels' new books for kids are Insects and Bugs for Kids and Insects and Bugs Backyard Workbook. More people are taking fewer precautions against COVID-19. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Why do some people follow guidelines while others ignore them? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Michael Berg, professor of psychology at Wheaton College, explores the factors behind such decisions.
When news of the COVID-19 pandemic first swept the United States, many Americans seemed receptive to following the guidance regarding how to stay safe and virus-free. However, non-compliance with preventative measures was at the heart of its spread. What leads to such behavioral decisions? My research partner Linda Lin and I created a survey to examine patterns in the relationship between people's health beliefs and behaviors. We wanted to identify the factors that were most strongly associated with following prevention guidelines at the outset of the pandemic. We examined participants' reported likelihood of engaging in 8 behaviors designated by the Centers for Disease Control as critical for the prevention of COVID-19 at that time. More than anything, the key factors that were associated with actively participating in preventative behaviors were how severe people thought the illness was and how much faith they placed in health officials. An additional event that appeared to persuade people to take the pandemic seriously was local school closings. Respondents living in communities where schools were being closed saw the pandemic as being more severe and were more likely to follow CDC guidelines. It appears likely that messages intended to calm the public by reducing the perceived severity of the disease may have inadvertently changed both perceptions and behaviors, leading some people to take fewer precautions. The other emerging factor was the degree to which people viewed doctors and scientists as influential in their health outcomes. Our research indicates that the more people believe such individuals play a meaningful role in their health, the more likely they are to listen to them. So messages where political leaders appeared to undermine health officials and organizations like the CDC also likely hurt engagement in prevention behavior.
That was Michael Berg of Wheaton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.